Open your Bibles to Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 4, we'll be reading from that in just a moment. I want to conclude today with the Nehemiah series. And hopefully that as we leave here, there'll be something in this lesson that will be beneficial to everyone here. That we can go home and say, well, I didn't know that, perhaps. Or you can go home and say, I want to change my life to be somewhat better type individual. If you are a Christian, to be a better Christian. If you're not a Christian, maybe perhaps today will be the day that you want to become one. And we're certainly willing and able to help you do that if you so desire. So many times people come to the church or come to a church and they're not familiar with the procedures or the tradition that some churches go through. And if you ever had an occasion to visit a different church, you'll understand you're kind of nervous because you don't know what to do. And I recall it's a story one time told that this guy went to a different church he'd never been in before, and he decided he'd just sit behind the guy in front of him, and whatever that guy did, he'd do. So all of a sudden, the guy was speaking in a different language, and all of a sudden, everybody in the church building stood up. So the guy in front of him stood up, he stood up. And they sat down, and the guy said something else in another language, and the guy in front of him stood up, and he stood up, and everybody started laughing. But the only two guys were standing. Come to find out, we was talking, they was going to christen a new baby, and they said, would the father of this child please stand? So sometimes customs and tradition are different in different churches. But I want us to understand that today, regardless of what tradition or custom we may have, the invitation of Jesus is always the same. Come unto me, all ye that labor or heavy laden, I'll give you rest. So with that said today, if you have a need at the end of the lesson, as Tony is leading us to this song, then let that need be known. And we'll certainly work with you any way we can. Talk with you, counsel with you, help you become a Christian by being baptized. Nehemiah, I give you just a short recap. I don't want to bore you with it, but by the same token, I want us to understand what Nehemiah went through. And with that said, Nehemiah had the occasion to go talk to the king, to tell the king what his problem was. The king, you know, gave him permission to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the wall. And when Nehemiah got there, recall, he traveled by night throughout the city and looking at the wall and surveying the job to see what's going to have to be done. And then he got the people together to rebuild that wall. And yet, as happens in the church today, as happens in society, as happens in your job perhaps, you always got somebody that's envious of you, that's jealous of you, or somebody just don't like the way you comb your hair or something about you. And you pick up an enemy. Use that term, someone who is against you. And with that said, the first thing you know, when Nehemiah begins to rebuild this wall, Sanballat and his buddies begin to give him trouble. And that's what we're going to talk about today and try to conclude this series. But Sanballat, of his own accord, when he saw what Nehemiah was doing, began to talk about him and to give him a hard time. Nehemiah 4, verse 1. It came about when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. Now, I want to skip through some of this to get the text of what we're talking about. Verse 3. Now, Tobiah the Ammonite was near him, and he said, even when they are building it, if a fox should jump on it, he would break their stone wall down. Criticism. Sometimes we get criticized, people become critical of us because we're doing something and we're trying to do the right thing, but we get criticized for it. And when that happens, how do you feel? You feel rejected, you feel bad, particularly when you know in your heart you're trying to do the right thing, and people criticize you for it. Now, Nehemiah responds with this, he prays, hear, O our God, how we are despised. Return their reproach on their own heads, and give them up for plunder in the land of captivity. Doesn't sound to me like he was turning the other cheek in this situation, does it? It sounds to me like he was saying, let's get even, because in verse 5, do not, forgive their iniquity, and let not their sins be blotted out before you. For they have demoralized the builders. Stick it to them, God, is what he's saying. Don't give them a break. Now in verse 7, part of 7, now when Sanballat, the rest of them, heard that the repair of the wall of Jerusalem went on, they were very angry. Now they tried this little talking bit. They have sent them letters. They criticized them. They sent letters to Nehemiah. I said, come, let's talk this over. Let's talk this over. Let's discuss this back and forth. And Nehemiah, in essence, says, I don't have time to fool with you. I got a job to do. I don't have time to worry about debates on this thing. I got a wall to build. And Sanballat and Tobiah realized what was happening, and they're angry still. Verse 9, Nehemiah says, but we prayed to our God, and because of them we set up a guard against them day and night. Having to go on the defense here. Having to defend what they're doing for God. And they're physically having to go on the defense. Verse 13, then I stationed men in the lowest part of the space behind the wall, the exposed places. And I stationed the people in families with their swords, spears and bows. Verse 16. From that day on, half of my servants carried on the work, while half of them held the spears, the shears, the bows, and the breastplates. 17. Those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried burdens took their load with one hand during the work and the others holding a weapon. As for the builders, each wore his sword girded at his side as he built, while the trumpet stood near me. Isn't that pathetic? Here are people trying to do the work of God, and yet because of enemies, Sanballat, Tobiah, they have self-proclaimed that they're going to destroy this work. And because of this, Nehemiah is so determined that he's going to carry this work out that everybody working on the job begins to defend or take armor to defend himself in case it comes to war. That's pathetic. What's it going to do as far as the work goes? It's going to cut it in at least half. And now if we look at Jeremiah, or at Nehemiah, bring up number 3, Paul, slide 3. There we go. I know this is not a good picture for you to view. However, I want you to realize something about the city of Jerusalem. If we scale this thing, you'll find it on the right-hand side, from the top corner down to the bottom right, it's going to be just a little bit over 1 mile. That is to the north at the top, to the east of the Kidron Valley. Now, Jerusalem is built on a mountain, if you please. And the one side, the east side, is just sitting right on what we call a bluff or a cliff. And the Kidron Valley is down below that. Some almost 2,000 feet, sheer wall. Nobody's going to attack it from that side. When Judy and I were in Turkey, one of the places we used to go quite often was a little, what they called a castle. Throughout that whole area, the castles were built on the highest plateau, the highest mountain, within sight of another one. And what this would entail was that they built these castles up on top with the big walls around them to protect them. They could see for days. It wasn't like F-16 going to fly over at the speed of sound and surprise them. For days in advance, they could see an army coming if they were going to be attacked. And they could get ready. One of the places we used to go and visit right outside of Adana was a castle called Snake Castle. Guess why it was called that? Their defense were snakes, because their complete castle was built on this area that if you walked around the base of it, it'd be about 2 miles, and everything was like this going up to that snake castle. It's very difficult when you're not under siege or not under fire or not under defense to climb the hill, to climb the mountain. But what they would do at the time at Snake Castle, as the people are climbing up rock, and I visualize them with a knife in their mouth, you know, maybe the bow and arrow over the back, and they're climbing up, and they come up over rock. Guess what the defense is? they turn loose buckets of snakes, poison snakes. And they had them, and it's still there while we was there, a large, large pit in the middle of Snake Castle where they kept these snakes, and they fed them for that very purpose. And when their enemies came and were climbing the hill, they wait until they was almost at the top and take a big basket of snakes and just dump them. They didn't have to fire a shot. And here is a guy hanging by his toenails and fingernails on the side of this cliff, and here comes a poison snake at you. There's only one way you're going to go, and that's back down. One of the biggest, largest defenses in that whole territory at the time was Snake. And Snake Castle was appropriately named. With this case in mind, if we look at Jerusalem sitting on this hill on the bluff of the Kidron Valley, we understand nobody's going to attack from that side. So that makes the attack possibility less dangerous. They won't have to come from the north or the south. There's another valley on the north side, which makes it very hard to attack. So they've cut their potential attackees in half from the south and from the west. Now, with that said, if you look at the east side or the right side of this map, from the very top down to the bottom, due to the curvity of it and all that, almost straight, it's a little over 1 mile, 1.1 to be exact. Now, if you go up here to Yale, North Yale, and head south, it'll be the same distance, because I clocked it, from here, from Yale to McDonald's, to the restaurant. That's the length of that wall on the east side, Kidron Valley. On the west side was about as long, although it's kind of cut and jagged going around. Almost a mile if you're walking it. About half a mile across the top and the bottom. So you see the size of Jerusalem at that time was a pretty good sized city. A mile long, half a mile wide. Now inside Jerusalem was the temple and all the gates and the towers, and all this was inside. Now with this in mind, remember Nehemiah is trying to rebuild the wall so that it can be protected. And he needs protection while he's building the wall to be protected. So the people are working half. Half as fast, half as much. Now with that said, verse 18. Each one wore his sword at his side while the trumpet stood nearby. Verse 20. Whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there, or God will fight for us. So we carried on the work with half of them holding spears from dawn until the stars appeared. From daylight in the morning until it's dark, till you can see the stars. Half of them are on guard or standing guard defense against a potential attack. Have you found this true sometimes in some of the churches you've been in? That a lot of the time is spent defending ourselves instead of pursuing sinners? That a lot of the times we hear people accusing other Christians of things that they had no business talking about in the first place. And in the second place, if they had business talking about it, they didn't go to the right location to the right people to discuss it. They go to someone else. For example, I can go to Tim and say, did you hear what Tony did? Instead of as Matthew says, going to Tony directly. Or vice versa, I can go to Tony and say, do you know what Tim said? Do you know what Tim has done as an elder? Why, that's repulsive. That's not the way that God or Jesus told us to go. And yet it happens in the Lord's church that sometimes there's so much turmoil and strife going on that we lose sight of what we should be doing. That we're so busy defending ourselves, sometimes from false accusations, and even if they're true, they're coming not directly to the people that's been accused. And that is ungodlike. And we should be ashamed of ourselves when we participate in anything like that. John will tell you, for years when I first went to Northside, one of the things that I hate to hear worse than anything is somebody told me this, but I can't tell you who it was that said it. And I've told them so many times, don't come to me with that kind of comments. If you don't want to tell me who said it, don't say it in the first place. Don't say what was said unless you're willing to give me a name. come to me and said, so-and-so is having trouble. It might be in their marriage, it might be with alcohol, it might be with whatever sin, it might be with stealing, whatever it might be. And I say, what did they say when you talked to them about this? Well, I haven't. I thought maybe the preacher might do that. That's not the preacher's job. It's your job as a Christian to approach the person that you think is having a problem. So with that said, here is what Sanballat and Tobiah are doing. They're creating a problem, and they're trying to stir up the people to stop the rebuilding of the wall. So Nehemiah says, if you hear the sound of the trumpet, wherever you hear that, all of you rally to that point because that means we've been attacked. So come to the defense at that point. Verse 22, let each man with his servant spend the night within Jerusalem so that they may be a guard for us by night and a labor by day. Think about this. If you're going to guard at night and labor all day, when are you going to sleep? I know early on in the military, Tony talked this morning about Japan. I was in Japan as a young man, and I got called on guard duty. And we would pull 4 hours on and 8 hours off. And that wasn't bad at first. But then the first thing you know, on that 8 hours off, well, you got to eat, and you got to do these other things, and there wasn't a lot of sleep. And after about the third shift on this, and I was on guard duty from 2 in the morning until 6. And I was so tired. So I went over against the airplane that I was guarding, which was a brand new type of jet that had just hit the theater in Japan. And I was so tired, so I said, well, I'll just sit down for a moment. And I just leaned back against this wheel for a moment, just to rest. Now, the government had issued me a weapon, a rifle, use that terminology, and I had it laid it at my feet, and I was just going to rest for a moment. The next thing I know, someone's kicking the bottom of my feet, and I opened my eyes. I woke up, in other words, and the sergeant of the guard said, asleep were you, and what's my first reaction? No, not me. I'm wide awake. I'm just resting, checking my eyelids for leaks. He said, you wasn't asleep. I said, oh, no. He said, well, how did I get your weapon on your lap and put it back over here out of the way before I woke you up? Because he didn't want me to wake up and shoot him on reflex. So you get so tired in cases like that. And can you imagine these people? They're working through the day. They're pulling guard duty at night. And I'm sure they're using some kind of system where they're getting some kind of rest. But by the same token, you know they're tired because they're running double duty. And yet in verse 24, neither I or my brothers or my servant nor the men on the guard who follow me, none of us removed our clothes. Phew. Each took his weapons, even to the water. How many days? I can't find out how long this went on. The maximum we'll cover in just a moment. But can you imagine staying in the same clothes for over a month? Can you imagine perhaps not even bathing for over a month? And when they went to the water, when they went to get water, some translations have suggested that they took this when they went and took a bath with their clothes on. Okay? Even so, they're not rested. Now, turn over to verse or chapter 5. Nehemiah says, in verse 6, I was very angry when I heard their outcry and these words. And he's talking about the people have come to him and says, we're being forced to pay usury. We've been forced to mortgage our land just so we can have food. Amongst all this other trouble they're having, here comes this problem. Nehemiah deals with it by going to the people who are holding these mortgages, so to speak, and says, don't do it. Don't charge these people interest or usury. Don't abuse them. They're trying to do a good job. So the time comes, they continue to work with the swords in one hand and their mortar mix in the other as they're putting this wall together. About 3 miles of wall. A little bit more of that when you count for the turns in it. So with that said, they got a lot of work to do. Now then, in chapter 6, verse 15. So the wall was completed in 52 days. Can you imagine building a wall from here to McDonald's in essence three times? About 3 miles. That's what it would boil down to. If you started today as we would, laying cinder blocks, 8 by 16, out in the middle of the highway out here, and laying those cinder blocks all the way to McDonald's, and then getting your cement or your mortar mix and putting another one there and laying it all the way back, and you back and forth until you get that one wall up. That's only a third of it. You do that three times. 52 days, I don't think I'd be able to do it. I don't think all of us probably be able to do it. It's a tremendous task. You got to understand, or we need to understand, remember they didn't have ready-mix concrete. They didn't have the wheelbarrows that they had buckets that they carried, but they had to do it the hard way. They had to, in essence, make their own concrete. They had to dig the sand. They had to haul the sand and the water, etc. So it was a difficult task, but the wall was completed in 52 days. That shows you the dedication, the commitment that they had on rebuilding the wall. Now then, look over at chapter 7, verse 66. Nehemiah decides that he's going to count the people. In doing so, he said the whole assembly together was 42,360. Now, before you begin to suspect that all 42,000, plus it goes on a few verses after that and tells some more about this person and the servants, and it really came out to more than 42,000 because come down there were 7,000 of male and female servants. So you're going to hit over 50,000 people here. Before you begin to suspect that 50,000 people are living in a radius inside of a mile and a half mile wide, we need to look at a little history. Some of that history is the chapter before Nehemiah, or the book before Nehemiah, in Ezra. Now, if we're familiar with Nehemiah, we should be by now. What Nehemiah did, he went to the king and asked for permission. About 11 to 13 years before this, Ezra had gone to the king and asked for permission, same thing, to go to Jerusalem to build the temple. Matter of fact, he didn't really go and ask permission per se. The king decided it needed to be done. So he puts out the word, and Ezra departs for Jerusalem to rebuild the temple, which is inside what we would call the walls of Jerusalem, which the wall's not been built. So we got two different avenues and two different jobs going on here, in essence, at the same time. Ezra is there busy rebuilding the temple, and Nehemiah is there busy rebuilding the wall. But Ezra started 11, 13 years before Nehemiah did. Think what a temple that must have been. And if we look at any of the history about the temple that was built, my. The gold and the silver and the inlays and all the work that was done, the wood, the fancy wood, amazing. Now, when all that is done, then we begin to read that Ezra, when the wall is complete, chapter 8, and all the people gathered as one man at the square, which was in front of the water gate, and they asked Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had given to Israel. Get this. He read from it before the square, which was in front of the water gate, from early morning until midday, in the presence of men and women, those who could understand, and all the people were attentive to the book of the law. If you can understand, let's say the child or the children, some of them are not going to understand what's being said. They're not there. I don't know where they were, but they wasn't there. The people could understand. Ezra read the law, the book of the law, the book of Moses to them. from early morning till noon. Now look at what they did. Ezra, verse 5, Ezra opened the book in the sight of all the people, for he was standing above all the people, and when he opened it, all the people stood up. You might say out of respect for the law, for the reading of the law, all the people stood. Can you visualize that? It's not difficult. I've been in congregations where I've asked the congregation to stand when the text is read. But can you visualize this, that Ezra gets up with the law of Moses and he begins to read verse 5, and when he opened it, all the people stood up. You stand early in the morning, let's say 6 a.m., and you stand there till noon while I'm reading the Word of God. Could you handle that? We begin to look at the clock when it gets close to noon now, but we didn't start at 6 this morning. And we get a little testy if the preacher goes to 12:15 sometimes or overtime. And yet the people weren't sitting on cushioned pews. They were standing and respectful as Ezra read the law. Verse 6, then Ezra blessed the Lord, the great God, and all the people answered, amen, amen, while lifting up their hands. Then they bowed low and worshiped the Lord with their face to the ground. This is a signal. This is a symbolic. Remember a few weeks ago we were talking about symbols and symbolic. When someone would prostrate or lay themselves flat out on the ground, that is the symbol of being the most humble that you can be. That was something that was required as a rule when a grunt or a nobody went in before a king. They bowed real low. Sometimes would get on their knees, sometimes even lay themselves out flat in front of the king. That's what happened here. People would bow or lay themselves before, worship the Lord with their face to the ground. That is being humble before God. As was mentioned earlier, last week and also this morning in class, Tony's talking about how many times have we been in trouble that we're standing faithfully and boldly and ask God to do something for us. Maybe we might try, and we don't like to use this word, but we try a little blackmail with God by saying thusly, Lord, if you do this for me, then I will do this. Lord, if you get me out of this mess, then I won't do this anymore. And it's a form of blackmail. I use that cautiously, but in other words, we're saying, and Lord, if you don't do it, then I'm not going to carry out the rest of it. But Lord, if you get me out of this mess that I'm in, then I'll straighten up and fly right. If you get me out of this mess that I'm in, how many of us, and we talked about a few weeks back, have uttered that silent prayer when we're in trouble? How many of us have uttered a prayer in secret between us and God with this kind of thoughts portrayed from our mind? Please, Lord, get me out of this. Instead of saying, God, I'm going to change my life, and if you don't mind, after I change my life, take care of this problem. But we put a condition on it sometimes. Get me out of this problem, and I'll fly right. I'll do the right thing. But these people here, all of them, lay themselves before God and humble themselves, and in essence, as we go on later on and read, they put sackcloth and ashes on themselves. That was a symbol of really, really, really being humble and in despair and not knowing what to do. Just lay yourself at the mercy of. We hear that sometimes in the courts of our country. I'm guilty. I lay myself or put myself at the mercy of the court. I don't know sometimes if that's a good idea or not. Just a thought. Because if that judge has had a bad day, if that judge's spouse has given him or her a hard time that morning before they left home. And if that judge is so inclined, they can take it out on you if you put yourself at the mercy of the court. But when we put ourselves at the mercy of God, we know that he's going to have the right approach. We may not agree with what God does. We may not agree with his punishment. And we may ask ourselves, God, why? Why would you give cancer to a little four-year-old boy and let those hoodlums rob a bank? God, why would you let that little kid suffer and let these people use drugs? God, why? Fill in the blank. But when we will take the approach of being humble before God, if we will humble ourselves as the indication here told us that they've done it, then God will take care of us. Because as we read more and more and more, in verse 10, eat the fat, drink of the sweet, send portions to him. Do not be grieved, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. And if we will let the joy of the Lord be our strength, then we'll have no trouble in this life. Can you imagine, have you ever, I say have you ever, that's a rhetorical question. Sometimes you've been depressed, maybe. Really down in the dumps about something that's happened in your life? Do you ever visualize God being depressed? Ever think about it? God gets angry. We know that. He's told it in his word. God is sad sometimes. But can we visualize God being depressed? There's a big difference between sad and being depressed. The joy of the Lord. There is joy in the Lord, and the joy of the Lord is our strength. That's what we read in Nehemiah. So if we will allow the joy of the Lord to put joy in our life, then the fruit of the Spirit is what? Love, joy, peace. Galatians 5. So with that said, would you evaluate your life today? Would you think about yourself and how you're doing and humble yourself before God if you have not done so? Humble yourself before God. Ask God for guidance in your life instead of trying to tell God what you want him to do. Go where he sends you instead of telling God where you want to go. Paul says, wherever I found myself, whatever condition I'm in, wherever I am, I've learned to be content. Paul, you're content being in prison? Yeah. Paul says, I'll convert people while I'm in prison. So no matter where I am, Paul says, I'm content there. May not be happy there, but I'm content there. So in our own life, I ask us today, are we content with our lives? And if we're not, then why not change it? It's a simple process. If you're not happy or content with what's going on in your life, change it. And God will reward us for it. If you have a need that we can help you with today, let it be known.